Ron Suskind has created quite a stir because of a number of allegations he's made in his latest book, The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. The Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist claims that the Bush administration had information from a top Iraqi intelligence official that there were no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq, intelligence they received in plenty of time to stop an invasion, and that the White House ordered the CIA to fabricate a backdated handwritten letter from the head of Iraqi intelligence to Saddam Hussein. The book is published by HarperCollins, and I'm pleased that it brings Mr. Suskind back to our show. Hello.
Hey, nice to be here.
Now, the news reports have focused on those charges that I just cited, but your book covers a lot more territory than Iraq. And your subtitle suggests that you had more than an indictment of the Bush administration in mind here, because you called it a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism.
You know, it's interesting because we're in this process where people are discovering the book, you know, sort of backwards to frontwards here. In fact, the whole point of the book is that there have been perfidies of official conduct and the gap, if you will, between the sort of public official morality and many people's private morality in this country creates an enormous sense of dislocation. That's what Americans feel. Gosh, is this my country? Another thing now. And interestingly, this extraordinary story, which may in fact be something that Congress takes up now as an impeachable offense, is just one of many of the sort of dark side offerings of the book. But the point of the book is how Americans essentially are using that as a starting point to try to find their own sense of moral compass, a moral code that will ostensibly lead us forward. And there are characters all through the book who do that. People read the book, they laugh and cry, and they say, gosh, that's us, that's me. And that makes me feel again like I might feel as an American. Certainly people are focusing, though, on the explosive allegations.
Well, you're talking about the stories of people like Ibrahim and Candace Gorman.
Yeah.
But before we get to them and to the explosive allegations, you mentioned impeachable offenses. Recently we had Nancy Pelosi here, and people have asked her again and again why Congress has not instituted impeachment proceedings. And she says, well, it just would bog us down. We're not going to do it. And there isn't enough time. There are too many other things that Congress has to do right now. Do you think that it would be possible to institute impeachment proceedings at this point?
I think the general thinking is that the Constitution is not a document to be employed at convenience or based on time frames. If there is a sense of a constitutional violation, Congress at any moment, whether it's one day left in an administration, needs to move forward as it is charged to do. And in this case, I think one of the issues is that Pelosi and others have been talking a lot about, would though we could, but there's no time. I think the difference here, whether you include them or even Scott McClellan, who talks about a culture of deception, et cetera, is that until now, there has not been essentially a kind of smoking gun in terms of what can be considered a high crime and misdemeanor. This extraordinary tale of the Iraqi intelligence chief as our secret source, how we pay him off and how we use him to deceive the American public, that last thing clearly in violation of statute, I think might change that.
You say the United States violated a 1991 amendment to the CIA statute that states no covert action may be conducted which is intended to influence U.S. political processes, public opinion, or media.
Absolutely right. Absolutely right.
And that's an impeachable offense.
Well, that's for Congress to decide. I'm not a lawyer, but certainly it's something that I think they probably will soon very soon begin to debate. It seems certainly to be in that category.
So what was your goal when you started doing this? To talk about the Ibrahims and the Candaces?
Yeah.
Or did the other stuff just fall into your lap?
Well, it's kind of interesting the way this whole thing unfolded, because ultimately the book starts with what I call the Armageddon test, which is the folks inside of the government who are chasing terrorists, who are trying to get to the uranium before the terrorists do. This is the great battle of this era. The world is filled with loose uranium terror networks as well as rogue states are out finding it. And so I was with those people. What I found very early on is they were saying again and again, the problem is that the United States has lost so much moral authority in these years that we can't herd cats in terms of nations of the world or command the kind of moral energy to get real action on this front that really could be, as they say, an Armageddon test. We're failing it. That was the start.
So you wound up looking into a situation in Georgia.
Right. It's
not the U.S. Georgia, the former Soviet Republic.
Right. It's interesting because one of the disclosures in the book of non-public information is that a 2003 smuggling case in Georgia of highly enriched uranium that shocked people, where it was 91% enriched, the kind of gold standard stuff. Actually, it was linked to a 2006 a smuggling incident. Now, of course, Putin and others say, we have this under control after 2003. They didn't. It was going on. This caused great consternation in the government. Again, not anything the public ends up finding out about.
Yeah, we never heard. I had no idea that there was anything. I mean, I know about Abkhazia in Georgia and the power struggle with Russia.
Well, it's stamped classified. That means, you're supposed to never, ever see it. And of course, at this point where they're classifying everything down to the lunch menu, there are many people, even in government, who say, boy, that system's broken. And the problem is that people can't know the basic things that they need to know in a democracy.
So people started slipping you these documents?
Well, yeah, I found out about this and found out about other things that are quite harrowing on this front. And I said, my goodness, we really are in trouble here. And I start to find characters, including a fascinating character in the book, this guy Rolf Moat Larsen, who's really kind of he's this brilliant, wild-eyed character who's really the main man in the government to get to the uranium before the bad guys do. And, of course, I find that he's quite frustrated. He's trying everything he possibly can. He's banging up against doors. And what he's running into is this issue, again and again, not just of bureaucratic nightmares, but also of the United States in this depleted position without this moral energy, not having the horsepower essentially to get done what needs to be done. So Rolf comes up with an idea to send teams out into the world, undercover teams, to buy the uranium before the bad guys do and then smuggle it back into the United States as a way almost to shock the system, shock the American government, if you will, almost like an insurgency, so that people say, oh, I get it now. We need to step up. And the book is all about how we somehow, as a nation of such awesome powers, manage to repair and restore moral energy. It's hard when there's so much assembled power in one place, and that's the great challenge for America.
One of the other shockers here that has not been talked about much were the suggestions in the very early days of the Bush administration to wiretap Vladimir Putin in a meeting in Vienna.
Yeah, it's quite an amazing moment because it goes right.
It does. It reveals a lot of stuff about all these other things that we've been hearing about.
Well, exactly. And what's interesting about it is it gets to this big issue, one of the great conundrums of this era, a real mess, of how Bush views the world in this sort of instinct-driven, sort of personality test. Me against them, man to man. What do they think of me? And his desire, his need to make things personal is something that has caused enormous havoc around the globe, because he looks at world leaders as buddies or guys who are maybe not doing what I want, and how do I get them to sort of maybe even go against their national interests? They don't do that. Relationships at this level, Leonard, are manufactured. Bush doesn't get that. But this wiretap of Putin, their thinking in the government, might help Bush understand, hear Putin's real voice, so he knows Putin's not his buddy, as other world leaders are not really his friends. He doesn't go for it. He says, I don't wiretap a friend, and he says no to it, and there's a great deflation, a dispirited moment.
Well, he was hearing from Condoleezza Rice.
She said it was a bad idea.
But somebody in the CIA said that if the surveillance were discovered, Putin would respect Bush because Putin is a former KGB guy, and this is the sort of thing he might think of.
Precisely. The whole idea is that, look, Putin is a professional, Mr. President. He's trained to make you think he's his friend, you're his friend, but he's really not. And, of course, Putin ends up managing the Bush-Putin relationship for years to come.
Now, first of all, I should tell people that my guest is Ron Suskind, and his latest book is The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism. It is published by Harper. All of the things that many of the revelations, anyway, have been totally denied by the Bush administration.
Sure.
And they say that you've just made them up. You're a conspiracy nut. I guess there are conspiracy nuts who win Pulitzer Prizes, and you probably would be one of them. But how do you answer that? How many sources do you actually cite in this book?
Well, you know, there are many off-the-record sources, but what I did here is I managed to get many people on the record in quotations throughout the book. The book is full of on-the-record quotes, many of them taped, so people can see things in daylight. The key here is to get out of the shadows and into the sunlight. And people get this themselves. Many of the sources, many of these, you know, prominent people, you know, Benazir Bhutto, of course, is in the book too, folks in the government, folks outside of the government. And on the issue of Habush, the Iraq intelligence chief, there are five significant on-the-record sources, people involved directly in the activities in and around Habush. It's not a matter of an off-the-record deep throat thing. These people are visible in daylight.
Do they feel that they need to speak out now?
Well, you know, I think part of it is yes, some of them feel they've been walking around with this lump in their chest.
Because
about
people
this.
Criticize Scott McLellan for waiting until he had a book deal before he talked.
Yeah, you know, none of these guys have book deals. You know, what they have felt though is that once I basically had the whole story laid down as to what was going on, I then in a way was able to free them. To say, you are not the source here, okay? You, though, need to provide us context and clarity and explanation. And that, in a way, liberates them so that they're not in a legal conundrum, a legal, you know, bind. As well, they can say something that many of them has been troubling their conscience for now many years.
Do you think people in government knew you were doing this? In your acknowledgments, you say that your research assistant, Greg Jackson, was sent to New York on a project for the book in September 2007 and was detained by federal agents in Manhattan. He was interrogated and his notes were confiscated.
Yeah, well, I think that people in the administration got wind of it at some point after the 1% Doctrine was done in 2006 when I started this. I think Greg's detaining, the way they detained him in Manhattan, I think that was probably not planned. But what was interesting is that when they did do that, the agents were very, very ardent about, okay, now who's your boss? Oh, Susskind, good. What's his next book about? Who are his sources? It's really quite extraordinary. And then they took his notes. All of this is a violation of the First and Fourth Amendments. I'm represented by lawyers at Covington and Burling. Those guys were, of course, ready to leap. I said, no, we shouldn't do anything like that. Let's just move forward. There's a book to report and write.
And you said that this book was one tough project.
It was, you know, because interestingly, the book carries the beating heart of the kind of human journey, which most books like this don't, as well as this most explosive, you know, sort of array of disclosures. Those two things tend not to be together, but my posit in this book is that they ought to be.
Well, the White House has denied your more damning allegations, accused you of making a living by writing gutter journalism. Mm. Tony Fratto, the White House spokesman, said about you, he's about selling books and making wild allegations that no one can verify, including the numerous bipartisan commissions that have reported on pre-war intelligence.
No, we have a situation here where this is now the third book for me in 4 years. You know, the first one, 2004, I wrote another book called A Hope in the Unseen, which people around the country read. But in the last three books about the issues of America at a crossroads, there has been nothing that has not been true and verified in any of the books. And, of course, this is just like, and the White House knows that, so they have to personally attack me as opposed to get into the details of the specific allegations. And that's what's happening now.
Well, let's talk a bit about what's been happening in the American intelligence community, which you deal with a lot here throughout the years. Has the CIA ceded much of its responsibilities to the DIA?
Well, the CIA is not the organization it once was. It now really doesn't even exist as it long did in America. The DIA oversees it, of course. which is kind of an umbrella organization put upon it.
Yeah, but you get the feeling that military intelligence is really the stronger partner there.
That's right. And for better or for worse, the kind of check the box, you know, support war efforts kind of intelligence, which is different from what the CIA has done, certainly when it was doing what it was paid to do, has really taken hold of the intelligence function in America. And so what you get are fewer and fewer people who can do the sort of mission, actually, this Habush mission, which is really sort of an emblem of the way the CIA used to work. It was in a way their last chance to prove themselves. And then, of course, the outcome of that investigation, that mission, was ignored by the political leaders.
What led you to the discovery of a secret pre-war mission to this man, Tahir? Was it Tahir Jalil Habush al-Tikriti?
Yeah, but Habush is al-Tikriti just means he's from Tikriti.
How did you even learn that he was out there and the odd circumstances of his life today?
Well, it's interesting. One of the original sources who I do mention in a sort of off-the-record, deep-throat quality, I sort of render him in the book to show that there is someone else. There was a discussion that he and I had, it's a he, about these issues of America's moral authority and how the problem is that this issue of going to war under false pretenses, which is something people suspect, and us not either finding WMD, I mean, what does he say? You know, the idea is that either we were incompetent or we lied. That issue became core, and he said his feeling was it was because we need to get to truth on this issue of the run-up to this war if we're ever going to command the moral authority that the world hopes we will.
Well, they claim that Saddam Hussein said he had these weapons of mass destruction, and they believed him.
Well, what you see in the book, step by step, is exactly what we knew and when we knew it. And what you find is the case was incredibly rickety and known to be rickety all the way through the fall of 2002 into 2003. Officials of all stripes are quoted here, finally saying, here's what really went on. So by the time Habush arrives in January of 2003, this is a structure that is teetering. And Habush essentially kicks it over and says, hey, there are no WMD there.
We're going to come back to Habush and Benazir Bhutto and a lot of other things, Michael Shipser and Joe Whipple and whatever else we can squeeze in here as we continue this conversation with Ron Suskind, author of The 1% Doctrine, The Price of Loyalty, Pulitzer Prize winner. His latest is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism, from Harper. Stay with us.
You're listening to The Leonard Lopez Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
We're back with Ron Suskind, who won a Pulitzer Prize for feature writing as a reporter for The Wall Street Journal, where he worked from 1993 to 2000. He's written three books, the first two bestsellers and the third sure to be a bestseller, about America during the Bush years, The Price of Loyalty in 2004, and then The 1% Doctrine 2006, and now The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism. It's published by HarperCollins. And let's talk a bit about Mr. Habush. You say that the Bush administration had been in contact with him, and he assured them that Saddam Hussein was bluffing when he claimed to have weapons of mass destruction. How can we believe anything that this man says?
Well, it's interesting. The book lays out week by week in January, when this was roiling at only the upper reaches of government, because many people weren't briefed, like, you know, Colin Powell, for instance, where the Habush dilemma presented itself.
He was a director of Iraqi intelligence.
Yeah,
he was a top guy.
He's their George Tenet, you know, maybe with a memory better than George's. And And so there he is. He's meeting with us in a secret location in Amman, Jordan. It's really a joint U.S.-British program, frankly. We set up the place he meets. And then he meets with the British head of the Mideast, Michael Shipster, who's really kind of one of their great intelligence agents. And Habush lays out not only that there's no WMD, and he has credibility, especially on the biological front, which we end up using in the case for war, because that's run by the intelligence service. He slips out and back from Baghdad. It's weekly, every other week, many phone calls, as the book shows. And it creates a kind of bubbling up mess inside of the government. Because on one side, you've got the intelligence operatives inside of CIA saying, my goodness, how lucky can we get? We have a window right into Saddam Hussein's inner circle. We can put anything through that window, disinformation. We can confuse them. We could send Habush back in with a team and take Saddam out. So, hey, we could walk to Baghdad rather than fight our way. That's one side, the operatives. Meanwhile, there's this other side, though, with the intelligence he's offering that there's no WMD, causing consternation inside of the government. These two things come to a head in early February of 2003.
And how is this being received in England? Michael Shipster's boss is Tony Blair.
Well, absolutely. Richard Dearlove is the head of MI6. Tony Blair is of course, the prime minister. Well, they're watching carefully as Dearlove and his deputy, one of his deputies, Nigel Inkster, say, look, this was our last best chance. We're good at this. We're better than you guys are. And we try to do our best to bring real intelligence to bear.
And you spoke to Sir Richard Dearlove.
Sure, yeah, on the record.
What did he say when you asked him about Habush?
Well, you know, he said, we did our best. This is what we're good at. And we move forward with this report. And what's interesting is that it's delivered. Dearlove has to fly. He flies to meet with Tenet in Washington to deliver the report personally. On Dearlove's side, they realize rather quickly what's afoot, that this is not going to be well received in America. Tenet says to Rob Richer, the head of the Mideast or the Near East Division, he says, they're not going to like this downtown. This is clearly a signature statement. He does brief the president, the vice president, Condi, about the Shipster Habush mission and the final report. Interestingly, Condi says to Tenet, for whom she has no love, she says, what the hell are we supposed to do with this here in the beginning of February? Tenet kind of shrugs and says, it's kind of your call. Ultimately, what happens, though, is that the Brits find out quickly that the U.S. want to cut off the channel. They don't like what's in the report. They want to end it. And he says,
because they're not hearing what they want to hear.
Essentially, that seems to be the case. And Dearlove says to me from the UK, he's the master now at Cambridge University at Pembroke College. He says, you know, the report came, he feels, too late for Cheney, as he puts it, to stop the war, because Cheney was so ardent, ferocious, come hell or high water, we're going in. He says, but it was not too late for Bush. He's quite frank and sober about this, meaning Bush could have stopped the war or stopped the train. Nigel Inkster calls us a runaway train, America, at that point. Dearlove's view, it could have been stopped, and we could have started to ask a different set of questions, such as, what do we do if there are no weapons there? Do we really want to do this war if there are no weapons of mass destruction?
Well, after the invasion, I would assume that Habush was somebody they'd be concerned about.
Well, they were indeed concerned about him. What's interesting is they cut off the channel, but they don't cut off contact, if you will. They tell Habush, thank you very much for your efforts. We'll be working with you up ahead, because they agreed to resettle Habush based on this mission. Resettle, it's kind of a loaded word. That meant initially that Habush gets out of Baghdad when the invasion occurs. He gets to Amman, Jordan. He's set up in his safe house there. And then, interestingly, as spring turns to summer in 2003 and the teams are finding that there are no WMD in Iraq, as many suspected, frankly, now they're seeing it's visible to the world, and the Joe Wilson-Valerie Plame controversy rears up, at that point, they decide they better dot the I and cross the T on Habush's deal, and the U.S. government decides to pay him $5 million.
But isn't he still listed as wanted on a State Department website? Up to $1 million reward?
Yeah, I guess that, you know, you do the math, I guess $4 million is the net. But the but in fact, at this point, he is a wanted man in all public ways. He's in Bush's deck of cards. You know, aptly enough, he is the Jack of Diamonds. I guess that's more appropriate than spades or hearts, considering his money. And as well, he is spoken about as a wanted war criminal. Of course, everyone in the innermost circle at the very top knows otherwise.
And then there's Mr. Whipple.
Well, that's
he's not squeezing the Charmin here, Joe.
Well, the tale of Whipple, I offer it conditionally in the book. It's a complicated story. There's even some things that probably are not in the book that are still locked away. But what's interesting about Whipple, he gets to this issue of how weak the case really was and known to be by the time Habush arrives. Because in 2002, Joe Whipple, who runs Berlin, he runs Germany for the CIA, is really a rogue agent of sorts inside of the CIA. They're quite concerned. He's a guy who has a history of complications romantically, and he's popping up all over the continent unauthorized. Vienna's calling, what's Whipple doing here? He didn't tell us he's going to be here. Apparently there are a lot of women, and there's also concerns because on our signal intelligence, our wiretapping of German intelligence officials, we hear them talking about Whipple and things Whipple is telling them that is very, confusing and problematic. You know, attacking Tenet, attacking CIA, and also sort of discussions as to the problems of curveball, which the CIA knows about in the summer of 2002. George Tenet says otherwise. It's not the case. Tenet was briefed fully that curveball was going to be a problem in the summer of 2002.
The Germans thought he was a problem, and pretty much everybody thought curveball was a problem.
They did at that point.
But they were citing what he was claiming anyway as reason to go to war.
Right. And Whipple, interestingly, we find out Whipple's advising the Germans, even though some people in the U.S. government, even some at CIA, are saying, look, we can't go forward unless we have direct access to curveball. That was part of what Tenet was advised by people in the know in the summer of 2002. Whipple, meanwhile, is advising the Germans, don't give them access to curveball ever. His view, and I talked to Joe, he's up at Boston University now, he didn't want to disrupt German-American relations. That was his priority, and to drag the Germans into the middle of this nightmare, and WMD would do that. Ultimately, though, Whipple's working across purposes with official policy. Beyond that, though, people do notice that Joe, oddly, is doing some things at the vice president's office and people at the Department of Defense actually kind of like. He's standing in the way of direct access to curveball, which would be a problem in the case for war. And Whipple ends up being rewarded mightily. He gets great jobs even after he's fired for his rogue agent problems. He becomes congressional liaison. People are shocked he's bad at it. He gets fired. He says, I was terrible at the job. And then he gets a special paid gig through the CIA at Boston University.
My guest is Ron Suskind, whose latest book is The Way of the World, A Story of Truth and Hope in an Age of Extremism, published by Harper. There are two things I want to get into in some detail, and we don't have a heck of a lot of time. The first is the one that probably is the most explosive accusation you make in the book, and one that the White House has strenuously denied, that it ordered the CIA to forge a fake letter from Habush to Saddam Hussein. They call your charge absurd. Who told you about the letter?
It is widely understood and well known. It's sourced to the fare-thee-well all the way through to completion. The White House probably, who knows, maybe they didn't even check with CIA on it. In any event, there is no doubt as to the White House ordering the CIA to do it and the CIA executing. People involved in it are on the record talking about carrying out the mission.
Now, many people have read about this letter because it was passed on in Baghdad to a man named Con Coughlin, a reporter for the Sunday Telegraph, the English Sunday Telegraph, who wrote about it on the front page of his newspaper December 14, 2003, under the headline, Terrorists Behind September 11 Strike Was Trained by Saddam. And it claimed that there was a legitimate, a real link between Saddam Hussein and al-Qaeda because Muhammad Atta had been trained in Iraq.
Right. It's a backdated letter, handwritten by Habib from July 1st, 2001, to Saddam, ostensibly, saying Atta trained in Iraq prior to the attacks, and, for good measure, Saddam is actively buying yellowcake uranium from Niger with help from the Al-Qaeda organization. You know, it solves, as people at CIA said, it's a check-the-box solution to all the White House's problems. In the fall of 2003, it pops up in Baghdad. It roils the global news cycles through Khan's story. Tom Brokaw talks about it mightily and at length. Con Coughlin is on Meet the Press in a remote from London. William Safire writes a column. It's on CNN. O'Reilly, he can't believe it. He's flogging it for 4 days straight on the O'Reilly Report. It's everywhere. And the problem here, Leonard, is that this is exactly why there's a law against this very thing.
This is disinformation.
It is. There was no way, really, that the journalists involved here could ever have known that this was a carefully crafted disinformation campaign. Ultimately, because of the overreach, I mean, had they put just one of these allegations in, or one of these proofs, if you will, I think it probably would have continued. But putting two at once, the White House wanted to solve everything. It's the overreach that often reveals power when it is abused. And I think this is a case where that happened.
Before the war started, the United States arrested Rashid Rauf and took credit for it. And that outraged the British. Why?
Well, it's an interesting moment. It's August of 2006 now. We have these sorts of stories like Habush all the way up to present, the back channel nightmare, the kind of official pronouncements of lofty rhetoric and backdoor perfidy. Here's a case where Bush and Cheney in July and August of 2006 very much want a deliverable for the midterm elections. They're quite anxious about it. The worst poll ratings for a sitting president, all the rest. Now, meanwhile, they find out that this British investigation has been going on a year about these airliners possibly coming to America. Well, they got some new information. They've got these guys wiretapped in the UK right down to their shorts, that the planes are ostensibly going to be pointed to the United States. Bush hears this, and he tells Blair he wants this thing snapshot. Blair says be patient, as do others in the intelligence community. No, we don't do what you guys do. We wait. We wait until there's something actionable. In this case, we've got these guys mapped every which way. So we can actually, if we are patient, maybe run this thread right into Zawahiri's beard. Be patient. That's where it ends. But Bush expresses his dissatisfaction to Cheney, and that's all that needs to occur. Suddenly, a CIA chief, the head of operations, is flying to Islamabad because the British plotters have a contact in Pakistan. He slips in. He meets with ISI, the Pakistani Intelligence Service. Next thing you know, Rashid Rauf is arrested. The plot all of a sudden snaps shut. The Brits have to run like lunatics through the night, arresting 25 people. They're livid. Interestingly, Jose Rodriguez, the operations chief for CIA, he's going to Baghdad, not fearful of the Pakistanis. He's fearful the Brits will pick up the fact he's in town. This is the first time this has been revealed. The U.S. has shrugged about, we don't know how it happened. But it's another example of us treating friends like enemies, which is why our moral authority is so spent.
Is Jose Rodriguez the guy who's gotten the New York Times into so much trouble because they revealed his name?
No. He's the guy who is in on the destruction of the tapes, of those videotapes of torture.
Okay, but you've brought us to Islamabad. And how does Benazir Bhutto fit into this story?
Well, you know, it's interesting because I meet Bhutto in the summer of 2007 when I'm there seeing Dear Love and Inkster and the British intelligence people. You know, remember, this book is a journey book. It's a little bit like the first book I read, A Hope in the Unseen, which is really a journey of the heart, an American hearts and minds story. This is a global version. And Bhutto becomes a character, just like all the others in the book, on a journey.
She is an admirable character as she has been portrayed recently because she was deeply implicated in supporting the Taliban and some of the other problems that have caused so much trouble in Afghanistan.
You know, I try very hard to show Bhutto accurately. We spend an awful lot of time together. We were on the phone every other night for months. and together often. You know, she was corrupt, and she would all but admit that.
And her husband.
There's lots of problems in terms of the things they had done. You know, these are not things that were secrets, frankly, in her innermost circle. But what you see with Buddha is an evolution, which is fascinating to watch. Because after the terrible explosion in Karachi, when she goes back, she's realizing that she probably is in a position to face some of the hardest issues, the hardest questions. At one point, she talks to Musharraf, it's in the book, where she talks about her security when she returns to Pakistan. He says, your security, in a brazen comment to her, is based on the state of our relationship. Make no mistake. She all but vomits. She gets back to Karachi. It's the worst blast, you know, terrorist attack in the history of the country. And then something amazing occurs. Buddha is still working in the back room like South Asian politicians do. Their appreciation for democracy is about like Boss Tweed or Richard Daley. But Buddha sort of stumbles into some pronouncements that are a little Martin Luther King-like. Next thing you know, Musharraf is acting in a strategic kind of foible where he puts her under house arrest. She is then doing press conferences in front of barricades and barbed wire. Her status starts to rise. It runs right through the last month of her life to December. So when I see her, Leonard, in Quetta a week before she dies, we're getting chased around town by suicide bombers. It's quite a moment. My wife was ready to murder me. I was like, I'm too old for this. But then that afternoon and evening, we settle, she and I, after so many conversations in the house of the local warlord who's really protecting her. And she really confesses things, including the fact that at this point she said, by virtue of the way things have gone, my numbers going up, Musharraf's plummeting, my success and his failure are the same thing now. There's no way to coexist. So now I'm taking on him and the whole structure of Pakistan, supported by the U.S., and also the jihadists, and I've been abandoned by America. Why won't Dick Cheney make the phone call to Musharraf, simply saying, her safety is your responsibility, and you'll be held accountable if she dies before Election Day.
And why do you think the United States didn't make the call?
Well, what the book shows is that deep down, and something that Buddha sort of tragically discovers, is that they basically went with Musharraf. They went with power, even illegitimate power, rather than stated democratic principles, which Buddha, in some ways almost against her will, starts to embody and embrace at the end of her life. She said something to me in Quetta. She's like, you know, I've been saying this thing about democracy for a long time, but, you know, finally I'm actually starting to believe it. It really does work. That evolution, though, somehow misses the attention of the White House. They still think things are fine. And ultimately, Buddha was left vulnerable. She feels abandoned, and she dies a week later in an extraordinary, tragic turn.
In just a few moments we have left, can we talk about Iran? Because Seymour Hersh has been running a series of articles suggesting that the Bush administration would love to invade Iran, even though it seems kind of crazy considering how stretched the military is right now. You say that the United States didn't pursue Iran's offers to help with al-Qaeda when the Iraq War started in 2003.
It's really interesting. You know, we talk about the Iraq War. I think one of the key justifications that they've not been made clear even now was to create a demonstration model, the defang Saddam Hussein they felt would be the easiest mark, and to make an example of him, the United States felt, would guide behavior in the region. Well, it actually works in one instance. Iran, around the time of the invasion, the Iranians essentially say, ooh, boy, 150,000 U.S. troops right next door. This is not working for us. All right, you win. What do you want us to do to help? They all but crawl across broken glass to say, hey, we can help with Afghanistan, Iraq. You know, these countries to us are like Canada to you. We actually know them. And we'll help with al-Qaeda because al-Qaeda had the Shura Council in Iran.
And they actually share a border with Iraq, unlike Pakistan, which only certain candidates think shares a border with Iraq.
Precisely. You know, Iran is the real power in the region. And what happens is the United States snubs them. It humiliates them. The Iranians sort of are befuddled, and they slip rather quickly. Remember, this is the time where they stop the weaponizing portion of their nuclear program, too. They kind of say, hey, what's the point here? you know, we've done everything. They still have snubbed us, because at that point in the administration, people were saying real men go to Tehran. They were so full of hubris. And ultimately, they all but create the oppositional Iran that, of course, has created enormous problems for the United States since. And the Iranians have been mischievous and quite active in both Afghanistan, in Iraq. And it's really because we said, we would rather see you dead than meet you at a bargaining table. And now we are years later saying, maybe that was the wrong decision.
Ron Suskind, latest book is The Way of the World, a story of truth and hope in an age of extremism, published by Harper. Thank you so much for being with us again.
Yeah, my pleasure, Leonard.
Up next on Political Projections, a look at how the movies have portrayed the way politicians can be corrupted by the system. This is WNYC and WNYC.org.